Address two things, something I thought of and then one thing that Pastor Carol brought up. I want to make sure I'm clear about something. When I keep contrasting Illinois and Tennessee, my suggestion is more about what another person asked me, not that there's all kinds of more Christians here, because that's, you could, like Pastor Carol said, you could walk around door to door forever and get the wrong answer a lot. The difference is something that another, I don't remember your name, Desi suggested, is that in Illinois, people just know they're not Christians. Does that make sense? They just are really, they believe in reincarnation or something random. And so it's really like my questions are much more vague and general because who knows what they may say. Whereas when I was doing ministry in Tennessee, you could go ahead and almost have a conversation inside the realm of Christianity, even if they gave me a works answer. A lot of times they weren't assuming that they were a Buddhist or a Muslim or just something like that. It wasn't happening that often. And so I would actually say it's more complex here than Illinois. I was much more refreshed. When I got to Illinois, I mean, it's even though it was sad that there was so much lack of truth, it was refreshing that people could just say, no, I'm not a Christian. That was just like, thank you. You know what I mean? Because now we can have a conversation, whereas a lot of times at Tennessee Tech when we were doing ministry, people knew the right answer or something right-ish. And so it was much more complicated to help them see, like, actually, I'm going to give you the true version of what you already think you believe. That's significantly more difficult. And I'll say to you guys what I said to her, which is at Tennessee Tech a lot of times for the people who gave me the right answers, I would again suggest, man, well, what if we did a Bible study called the Journey Books? You know, and that was kind of more like understandable. They were in a church culture where people did Bible studies, even though maybe they'd never been in one. And they were okay with that, you know, and over time we would get to a point to where the thing that's hard is when I don't think you're a Christian and you tell me the right answer, the pressure I feel is to not allow you to believe that to be true when I really doubt that it is true. That's the pressure you feel. And the pressure you feel is that I want to address this now, but it's just probably not the best time to immediately look back at them and be like, you know, I really doubt it. You know, I don't know that that's the best way to go about it. And the thing the Journey Books do is it sets you kind of up on the tee to get into the process of talking about the gospel to where you finally land on the thing that they have never understood about it. Then you can begin to discuss that particular point and their life and how it looks and the things they believe. And you can begin to unwind the things that they actually have misunderstood about the gospel. And it just makes things a little bit more simple than just coming right out and being like, man, I don't think you're right. You're a Christian. Because that's pretty risky relationally. I'm not trying to suggest you shouldn't risk relationships. But there may be a more wise way to risk it than just to immediately shoot back something that cuts off your ability to ever have any more conversation. So just a thought. Because we definitely... I would describe our ministry at Tennessee Tech like a ministry of convincing people they weren't Christians almost. You know, that was almost what it was. It wasn't even evangelism as it is even in Illinois. So definitely plenty of need here. It's just a different kind of thing a lot of times. So the other thing is these things I'm telling you guys, like Chris, we were talking and he was getting the exact flow of questions and I was thinking, I hope no one thinks like, before I go and like spend time with guys, even now I'll think like I'm gonna ask this question, then I'm gonna ask this question. Like I will play it out in my mind, even as someone who does this all the time. I don't want you to leave and feel like I can't remember the exact flow of questions or like. I don't think you need to be stymied by that. I think you want to think, okay, like before I'm going to hang out with so and so, you may just play it out in your mind. Just think, okay, like because you get nervous, you know, and you don't know what you're gonna say, and if you've just thought about it a few times. When you get there, you just are much more apt to take the risk and ask the question that you plan to ask instead of thinking, I'll just figure it out in the moment. Because what I do, and probably a lot of you guys do, is you get in the moment and you give yourself the 50 reasons why now isn't the time to bring this up. That's what I do. Okay, like I shouldn't bring this up right now. This isn't the perfect time. I'll wait for another time. We just do that continually until we never end up doing anything. You guys relate with what I'm saying? I feel that a lot. And so just knowing I'm going to go do this is helpful for me in evangelism. So real quick, before we jump into a bunch of new stuff, what do you guys have any just particular questions? Some people asked me some questions, but I don't want to move on if you guys have got something that's like, I really want to ask this, or I think this could be helpful. All right. Oh, Jane.
Do you ever jump into the gospel with anyone that you don't have a friendship with?
Yes, most definitely. Yeah, really often. And so not necessarily really often on the campus, you know, but maybe in public, on the train, you know, just I'll tell a story. I'm going to try to sprinkle in some stories just to make it kind of real life as I go. I'll tell you guys a story now. Just sorry, this is an example of that. When I used to work at Smith County High School, some of you guys even know this guy, I don't remember his name, but I was a teacher there, and I would try to share the gospel with various people, and there was a janitor that I noticed who would kind of sit down away from the teachers each day, or every few days he would sit down there by himself, he would never sit with us. And just kind of thought, I'm kind of in this big group of people. They're like 20 years older than me. I don't really know how to like commandeer the conversation and evangelize 10 people at a time. Again, I'm not a super evangelist. But I thought, I bet I can share the gospel with that guy. He's all by himself down there, you know. And so I remember going down there one day and just sitting with him and striking up spiritual conversation, asking him a key question. He told me the wrong answer. I progressed to just share the gospel. We didn't have any kind of friendship, any kind of relationship. But I felt like he understood. He began to kind of spit it back to me, and it was just clicking. And he was 28 years old, and I remember, this is even more than you're asking, Jane, but I'm going to use this story later to make a point. But I remember finishing the conversation and being like, man, you just seem to really get this. Like, what's keeping you from becoming a Christian? Like, what's the thing that's holding you back from saying, I'm going to follow Christ? And he just said, man, I just got... You know, I'm 28 years old. Like, I've got a lot of life ahead of me. I don't want to do that right now, you know. And, you know, we talked a little more. I don't really remember what I said. And that was a Friday afternoon. And that Monday, the very first thing that came across the intercom was, we're sorry to announce janitor so-and-so had a massive heart attack on Saturday and died. And I remember texting Sheffy and being like, you will not believe what just happened. And the story... One, I didn't have a friendship with him, and I did launch into the gospel, and I felt like I was faithful, you know, to what God called me to do, and I, you know, didn't feel any kind of guilt or anything, you know, like I could, you know, we don't believe you can manipulate people in becoming Christians, and so I didn't feel like I should have manipulated him, you know, but it was just this reality of, as I was telling him, man, this is foolish that you are not going to give your life to Christ, like, you're not the captain of your own soul. You're not sovereign over your own life. Like you submit him to God. You know, and even as he told me, Zach, I'm 28 years old. I could live for the next 50 years. Even I kind of believed it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I guess so. And that dude died within 24 hours. And I just remember just realizing, like, man, we are in no way in control of our own lives. And this guy had no idea. He was taking some of his last breaths as we were talking about the gospel. And within 24 hours, at 28 years old, massive heart attack. It was the craziest thing. I don't remember his name. Some of you guys may remember that. But anyways, just 2 days before that, we'd had an extensive gospel conversation. We weren't friends. And so that would definitely be one example. But there's a reason I went into all that. I will use that later. But yeah, I mean, every summer we do, yeah, if I'm on the train or on a plane and I don't always, you know, but if the guy will talk to me, a lot of times I'll give it a shot, you know. And this is one thing, I'll just say one thing about this. I think this is so helpful for me, is that at some point I begin to realize, like, I don't know always how to do evangelism the best way, but the one thing I can do is just fire up a conversation about whatever, you know what I mean, and just try to see what happens, you know what I mean? Not forever ago, sorry, I know I'm telling another story. Maybe this is just helpful even just to think about real life stories, but I was on a train to Kankakee, another college I visit from time to time, and I sat down next to this old guy, and I'm in a different context right now, sorry, I need to remember. Yeah, sorry, he was like 29, no, I'm just kidding. He was probably 70, and we got to talking, you know, about this and that and math. Told him I was a math education major. And he's like, I'm a math guy. And it turns out he got his doctorate from MIT in 1969 and had been a teacher at U of I for the last 40 years. And I realized when he said he was a math guy, and I said when I was a math guy, we're talking about different things. And so this guy was, you know, just a, you know, a genius, you know, just obviously brilliant. And I remember thinking to myself, I know you're going to get off in Champaign, and that's probably 20 minutes from here. And I don't know, and pretty soon in our conversation, he was real clear about the fact that he didn't believe the Bible's true, didn't believe all these things. And honestly, like, if I, in early on in the conversation, there's no way that dude wasn't way smarter than me, knew way more things than me. This isn't like what I was saying earlier. This is like, you know, a million times more things than I do. Very conversant, read tons of books, church history. He was working his way through a 7-volume set of church histories at the moment, just for kicks, because he likes that kind of stuff. And I remember just thinking to myself, this is worth a shot, you know? And so he would tell me things he believed, and I would just say, what do you mean by that? And he would tell me, and then I would say, why do you believe that? And by the time the conversation was over, as crazy as this sounds, he was like, I do need to think about this. And you may think, Zach, that's a failure. You should have crammed the gospel down his throat in the 20 minutes that you had. And I just would tell you, I just disagree, is that I don't, he would not have conversed with me about the gospel. Does that make sense? But I was just trying to be as faithful as I could in the moment. And it was just like, what I was trying to do is to say, God, if we get to the gospel, we get to it. I'm trying to get there, but I'm trying to get this guy to open up to me and say, share the gospel with me, basically. But we were having to work through so many things to get there. But my hope is, because God's sovereign, that He's going to bring in another person. That guy's going to go do some of the research that I asked him to do. Like, have you ever considered this? And he was like, nah, I really haven't ever considered that. And, you know, it's like, and then he got off the train, you know. But the point, the only reason I bring that up is because I just think so many times in evangelism, we get up to the plate like, I've got to hit a home run. I've got to hit a home run. And it just is so scary to feel like you have to hit a home run. But it's like, you're not sovereign. You don't know what's going to happen. You've just got to be faithful to get into a conversation, try to get to the gospel. I'm not saying don't try to get to the gospel. Does that make sense? Be content with just saying a couple things and moving on. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, I'm going to start moving towards the gospel with this person, talking about football or baseball or whatever, and I'm going to pray that God's going to move this conversation to the gospel. Sometimes we get there, sometimes we don't, but I'm not discouraged when we don't, because I can't control the people that I'm interacting with. And I just think we've got to be more open to beginning conversations that may only end up being conversations, but we feel the pressure to preach the whole gospel, every conversation. And I'm just telling you, I've had enough evangelistic conversations to know you're not going to get to do that every single time. And you can't just say, well, if I'm not going to preach the whole gospel, it's not worth it. It's not true. Is that I'm going to do as much as I can in the time I have, and I'm going to pray that God brings that guy to the next person who's going to pick up where I left off. And so I'm not content to stay there, but I don't control when he gets off the train. And so we just got to be okay with that. So anyways, that was so many more things than you ask, but I hope maybe that feels like something concrete for you guys even to think about. So any other questions? Okay, cool. Anybody want to volunteer? Maybe a person they're thinking about and like how they're thinking they might pitch an evangelistic study to them? Okay, but you will later, I'm sure. So I know you guys didn't have a ton of time. Obviously, you give a quick break. You guys are eating and things. But the point is just, what I wanted to do is have like a 5-minute, like where actually just people sit down and wrote. But the only reason I ask is because I really do think you want to cement in your mind how you're going to say it and what you're going to say, because it just comes out, it just is so much less fear when you just know, and this is how I'm going to say it, this is how I'm going to pitch it. So for me, I just would say that. So anyway, so if I were you, if I was thinking there's a 1% chance that I'm going to use these journey books, what I'm about to start doing is we're about to start rolling through how to use the books well. And if I were you, what I would do is I would have one set that I'm writing in that are going to become my master set I'm looking at when I'm meeting with people. And then I would have the other set would be the set I would actually hand the person, like, hey, here's journey book one, and it has nothing in it. They read it, we meet, I have mine, you have yours. And so to do an evangelistic, you know, endeavor with another person, you would need at least 2 sets of journey books, not right now, but 1 to give away at another point. So so that's what's about to happen. So if I were you, I would write some of the things I'm about to say in your journey books. Here's just a few things about using the books well. And again, we've used the books a lot. We've thought a lot about, at least practically, how to use these books to evangelize people. And so I want to give a couple thoughts about the use of the books in general. One is that you're the evangelist. The book is just a tool. Is that I am evangelizing Johnny. And I know Johnny because we have a relationship. And so, for example, in these books, there are questions on the side. You'll notice them. Some of them are pertinent to those people. Some of them are not. And so because I'm the evangelist, I make the choice what questions I want to discuss when we meet. I don't waste time talking about questions that are irrelevant to that particular person because it's just going to waste time and make things boring. I'm evangelizing them. This is the content of the gospel. I'm going to come in and say, hey, man, you know what? Let's skip that question. Let's talk about question two. You know, we're going to talk about that for a little while. And I'll say more specifically in each book what I'm talking about. So don't use every question. This could be controversial. You guys don't have to agree with me about this. It's a suggestion. Every book ends with a question that leads to the next book. Okay, and so, like, for example, at the end of book one, after it talks about who God is and what He's like, it says, God has made you for clear purposes. God has been very forthright concerning what these purposes are. How well have you done at living out these purposes? And actually, that's a terrible example. But it's a question, and later on, once you talked about their sin, the book ends with, what do you think God's going to do about it? And so, obviously, all our temptation is to want to share with them about Christ right then. And you can. I'm not saying don't do it. But the thing that I found, agree or don't agree, is that I just want them to sit on some of that stuff for a second. I just want them to go home and think about their sin and think about the things they've done and for the very first time consider, God takes this personally. This is not a mistake. He doesn't understand. And I'm gonna let them think about that for a week as they have the gospel in their hands. Like, by the time they get to book three, they're reading about Jesus Christ. And man, let them pick it up and read it and get it and say, man, we need to meet sooner. Or like, let's say I'm in book two with a guy and he just realizes, man, the Spirit is just convicting him of sin. He's like, Zach, I can't wait for a week to talk with you about book three. I'm not going to say, well, you're going to have to. I'm going to say, here's book three. Let's meet tomorrow. Does it make sense? And obviously, this is my full-time job, and so you guys may have to move some stuff around to do that. But the point is I just think you want to stay away from answering questions from later books just because you already know the answer. Like, they're going to ask you questions about things, and you're going to say, oh, we're going to get to that later. Like, I just think it helps them process the information at hand because we know this. I know this from evangelistic conversations in the South, is everyone wants to get to the Jesus part. Does that make sense? So they can just be like, oh, that's right. Right. Yeah, I know I'm a sinner. Yeah. That's why Jesus died, right? And that's why I'm fine. That's why we don't even talk about this anymore. Does that make sense? That's what everyone wants to say. And so when they're like, well, man, what is going to happen about my sin? It's like, well, hey, man, just read this book and we'll talk about it. And I want them to think about it. And I can't tell you the number of times we've come into book three and guys are ready to talk about Christ because for the very first time they have thought, I'm a sinner and it's not okay. And I just, letting them sit on it has, I think, been kind of cool. So I don't know. You don't have to agree. You don't have to do that. Feel free to do it however. So, it sounds like you're like withholding truth from people, but I mean, typically we don't have any problem withholding truth from people all the time. Does that make sense? Is that we naturally withhold truth from people constantly. The fear we have in evangelism is I care more about what you think of me than I care about you. And so we could all make the case we withhold truth from people all the time. And so if you want to say, hey, Zach, the fact that you don't tell people what's in Journey Book 4 and Journey Book 2 is withholding truth from people, you know, we're all guilty. Okay, and so just... I've had this conversation with like 1,000 people. And so this is definitely a common thing people discuss when they talk about the Journey books, whether you do or don't withhold various parts. So just a thought. You want to keep your Journey book time to 30 minutes, okay? Like, and this is why you guys think, why would you do that, you know? And I'll explain why. Is all kinds of guys use the Journey books, and they'll come back, and they'll say, man, we did Journey book 1. 2.5 hours. We were talking about this and that, and it was awesome. I'm like, man, that's awesome, you know? A week later, they're like, man, Joey canceled, you know? I'm like, oh, really, man? That stinks, you know? Well, maybe next week, you know? Joey canceled again. And eventually what you begin to pick up is because you took 2.5 hours of his life, when you ask him to meet again and he didn't have 2.5 hours, he thinks, man, I can't meet up with you. I don't have 2.5 hours again. Does that make sense? Because we're so excited to talk about this stuff. We'll talk about it forever. We're like, oh, yeah, let's keep talking about this. And Johnny's really thinking, hey, I kind of got to go, but you're so pumped about this. And he kind of lets you keep doing your thing for another hour while he's thinking, I'm never going to meet with you again. This is taking forever. And so I just think you want to be sensitive to people's life and time and just say, look, man, I told you 30 minutes. And we're done. Or, hey, let's meet for lunch. And like you eat for 30 minutes, you pick up the books. Like, hey, let's talk about this. And at 1 o'clock when lunch is over, I say, hey, man, thanks a ton. I really enjoyed this. And if he's like, man, I got some more questions. There's some things I want to talk about. I'm not going to say, sorry, I said it was me 30 minutes. Oh, we're going to talk as long as he wants to talk. Does that make sense? But I'm not going to make him sit there for 2 hours when I told him 5 weeks, 30 minutes, or an hour for eat lunch. I'm going to have integrity. I'm just going to do what I told him I'm going to do, and he's going to have integrity, and he's going to keep meeting with me. And if he wants the meeting to go longer, I'm always willing, but I'm not going to make him sit there longer. I think that's really important when we pitch these things to people. They just feel like it's like a bait and switch. Like, you told me we were going to meet for 30 minutes. You want to talk for 2 hours. If you don't know, say you don't know. If somebody asks you a question and you don't know it, don't pretend you know, and don't try to make something up. Just like I just told you, when you ask them a hard question and they don't know the answer, and it's really obvious you don't know, and that's why I'm pitching the journey books to you. When you get asked a question and you feel like I have to make something up to pretend that I know right now, guess what? They know. You have no idea what you're talking about. You're just making this up. And again, it's just not honest. It's like, if you don't know, you don't. You say it. You just tell the truth. I don't know. But I'm going to go meet with Pastor Donnie later today. I'm going to ask him that question you asked me. And when we meet next week, I'll tell you the answer. And you learn a lot of stuff as you get your questions answered. And then you become a better evangelist over time. And then lastly, just as far as using the journey books, is that we're going to use a diagram just to explain the message of the journey books. But the reason is because, let's say a guy misses a meeting and it's 2 weeks before you meet again, he can forget kind of what we've already covered. And so we're just going to kind of use something to remind them. So in the beginning of each book, you're going to draw a picture that kind of explains what we've said up until that point. And when we finish the book, we'll draw a picture that sums up what we've talked about. Does that make sense? So I'm going to explain that diagram right now. And so maybe you want to write this in your notes or in a journey book. And so basically, the books are just kind of running through a flow of thought of the gospel, okay? And so just, who is God? What is He like? And so in book one, what we learn is that God is the creator, king of the universe. And He has some really important characteristics. He is both loving and He is just. And He's both those things. Both those things are part of who He is. And so this is who God is. And He has made us, men, in His image, to know Him and to reflect Him in the world. And so this is who we are. This is what we were made for. This is who God is in general. Obviously, there's more things you could say about man and God. And so at the end of book one, I say, hey, listen, this is what we have covered, is that this is God, Lord, no, everything I just said. And so this is kind of the picture that comes up in the beginning of book two. So we get to book two, I draw this again. I say, let's remind ourselves what we said from book one. We said that God is the creator of the world. He owns you. He is both loving and just. He made you to reflect His image in the world. This is what you were created to do, and to know Him in that. And so the question becomes, well, how have you done it living out that purpose? Well, the answer is what we have done is we have become, it's a terrible crown, big man, and we've said, God, You are not the king. You're just little g God. I'm a big deal. We rebel. We say, no, I'm not going to reflect You. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. Sorry. I'm the king, and this is how I'm going to do my life. Okay? And so what you kind of end up in book two is that God, I do not have a relationship with God anymore. God does not function in a relationship like this, is that He's not going to be okay with me calling all the shots and usurping His reign over my life. That's not okay with Him. Okay? And so book two ends. And so we start book three. What's God going to do about it? And so in the end of book three, at the beginning of book three, I draw this whole picture again on a napkin or something at the restaurant. And I say, this is what we've said so far. Now let's talk about what God is going to do about it. And so we remind ourselves again that God is actually the creator and king who's both loving and just and I'm just little M man, and I'm separated from him, okay? But in book 3, he explains that God, before I drew this, book 3, when you read book 3, it explains that what God is going to do about what you've done is he's going to bring his wrath on all people who rebel against him, and that is represented by a little X. And so not only we don't have a relationship with him, but his wrath is coming against us if we do not respond, or if something doesn't happen. They don't know at that point what that is. And so in book 4 or book 3, they find out this doesn't have to be this way. He sent Jesus Christ to die on the cross and give us and reconnect us to him. Through Jesus Christ's death, he both gave us his perfection and he took our penalty. Because he's just, someone had to take the penalty for what we've deserved. And because he's loving, he gives us his perfection in our place so that when God looks at us, he sees Christ's righteousness. And so that's how I can become united to God again. And so then it asks the question, well, even if this is true, there's still many people that are going to hell. Why is that? They will most definitely want to know. Again, you can make the decision, tell them now, give them the book, tell them you'll meet with them tomorrow, however you want to do it. Book 4 comes along and says that we have to turn to God in repentance and to trust him in faith in Christ. Okay, and so I'm kind of blazing through this because I'm assuming that you guys already could explain the gospel message. But the point is this picture right here is the picture that I'm unfolding. At the end of each book, I'm summing up what we've said in that book, and at the beginning of each book, I'm summing up what we've said before. Is that? I'll stop here for 1 second. Is that clear as mud?
I've got a question.
Okay.
On your third diagram.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Oh gosh.
On your third diagram. Is the third diagram basically the same as the fourth one? And what I mean is
oh, the third diagram.
The third one right there goes in the back of the third book.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. After the third book, they're gonna see everything but this.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Okay. Yes.
In the fourth one.
The fourth one will sum all this up, but we've not talked yet about how they respond to what Christ has done. And so we're going to talk about faith and repentance. And so here in Tennessee, typically if you guys have been in an evangelistic conversation with a person who kind of already knows, yeah, Jesus and that, it's like at that point you really begin to flesh out what does it look like to truly believe and to repent. And that's typically a pretty pivotal book for Tennessee, I would say. Chris, I answer your questions. You good?
I guess I'll let you go on. Are you done with your diagram?
That's it.
Okay.
Okay. Let me just say this. Obviously, what I just said to you in 30 seconds is much less than I would say to a person if we had, you know what I mean? I'm sitting here at the restaurant, and there's a lot more things that the journey books are saying, and I would say, about a lot of these things. Does that make sense? And I'm just assuming, that's one of the things I'm assuming that you guys have got in spades here, is that you could explain the gospel to another person. If I said, hey, why is it that God's going to bring his wrath on me, that you'd be able to explain why? Or why is it that I can't have a relationship with God and do whatever I want, that you'd be able to explain? Or God's loving and just, and what does that mean? Those are all things that I do think that you guys would probably be able to explain. And so, this is just the general how I would use it. The pictures are just helpful to sum up what I've said and to sum up what I've said in past books. Is that good? You guys good with that? Okay, great. Open up book 1. I want you guys to see kind of how this works. And so you'll notice if you turn to the back on page 9, there's an appendix that said, is there absolute truth? Is it knowable? And then a page later, you'll see, is the Bible trustworthy? Over the years, we just kind of realized that these were kind of the two biggest questions that people have. Obviously, there's an infinite amount of resources. This is a very small article about each of those ideas. And we would just, and the reason they're in the back is because a lot of people don't really ask these questions. They're not really asking that. And so we don't want to raise issues that are unnecessary. And so, and people typically aren't dying just to read more than you ask them to. And so, but suppose that I am dealing with someone who does have these kind of issues, I may say, hey man, why don't we just make sure you read the back, because I want to talk to you about why I think that I really have the truth and that we can actually know it. Or let me explain to you why I think the Bible really is true. And you can learn, I mean, obviously, there's tons more information that you guys could have about explaining the answer to those questions. But this is just a small way to get onto the topic. And so that's all I really have to say about the appendices there at the back. And so that you use them if you need to use them. But really, the book itself is just really just that, those few pages in the front. And so turning back to the beginning of page one, or the beginning of the book, I would just say this. This whole book is just answering this question, who is God? And again, you can feel free. I don't want you guys to feel like that if you're like, man, I really think there's this other thing about God that I feel like would be super important to explain. Like, again, you're the evangelist. This is just a tool. You could say, I think the journey books are deficient. Like, they don't say enough stuff. And that does, it's fine. Like, you know, but you can say whatever you want. You're the evangelist. You can say, hey, man, let's open up to this Bible passage. I want to talk about this other thing I think is crazy important for you to get when you guys meet. Like, you can do it however you want. But the thing this thing is guaranteeing is that you get to talk about a significant amount of the gospel. And so when we're going to meet up, can I erase this board? When we meet up, we're going to... Thanks, dude. When we meet up, we're going to kind of, again, we're going to have to kind of bust through some of these. I'm just going to hit the points that I think are helpful for you to as you use them. But I can't cover all the content in here. Obviously, that would take forever. And so on the first page, one of the things we want to do is help people understand what it means to respond to the Christian message even before they know what it is. And so at the beginning, bottom of page one, it says, one of the reasons this is important is because the Christian journey not only involves acquiring knowledge, but also asks for both agreement with that knowledge as well as commitment to it. And so the way I want them to understand what that means is this journey we're about to go on, as I explain the Christian message to you, it's not a message just asking for you to understand it or even just say, yeah, I think that's true, and which is how I viewed Christianity growing up, is that it's just something if you give mental assent to, everything will be fine. So on the front end, I want to be clear with them and say, this is the nature of this message is like this, and this is the illustration that I'll use. I'll say, this is the line when I crossed over from not being married to being married. And there was a point where I kind of got to, I knew who Sheffy was, you know, and I began to grow in my knowledge of her, okay? And then there was a point where I said, you know, I agree that Sheffy, she's somebody I want to marry. Like, she's got all the things that would make me say, you're going to be a great wife. I agree. And so I said, Sheffy, will you marry me? Okay, and we got engaged. But then there was a moment that was even different from that moment where I committed my life to Sheffy. And the nature of the Christian message isn't just asking you to say, oh, I like that. That makes sense, you know. And it's not just asking you to say, I agree. Like, I give my mental assent. Like, yeah, Sheffy, I think, will be a great wife. There are probably a lot of people that knew Sheffy well enough to say, yeah, I think that Sheffy would be a good wife. But it's very different than what I did at point C, which is said, I'm so convinced and I love you so much, I'm going to commit myself to you because of all these things. And I think that's the thing the Christian message is requiring of you. It's requiring you to lay down other things to follow Jesus Christ. And they don't even understand what all that means, but we want to help them understand, like, this message, it's not about just mere information. Like, something happens to you. You commit yourself to something in a way that isn't just about mere information. So that's just a simple diagram, not that awesome. But people love diagrams. So you guys can love them or hate them, I guess, but I promise you, people love them. So, so if I were you guys, I would definitely hit on this question on page two. I would maybe just star some of the questions I point out because I don't always use all the questions. If you were asked to describe God's character with two or three attributes, what would you say describe Him? And so just let people talk about anything and everything they say that's right. You're like, man, that's right. That's good. Just you want to champion every bit of truth that they believe. Like, I think it's great that you understand that about God. That's right. Like, He owns us. Like, He is the Creator. That's so true. Great, you know. And I'm getting an idea of what they believe about God as they talk. I'm not always telling them, no, that's wrong. Like, unless they say something crazy, you know, I'm obviously, then I would tell them, no, I don't think so, you know. But if it's just kind of like, I just know there's more truth coming that's going to begin to help them think about this. And so I'm not always trying to slap their hands every time they say something that could possibly be perceived as theologically inaccurate. And so I don't typically ask the question at the bottom of page 2. On page 3 right there, it talks about God's love, it talks about His justice, and it asks a question there on page 3, and I typically ask that question to people that in our relationship I've noticed that they've been sinned against greatly. Maybe they were like a rape victim, or maybe their parents did something really wicked to them. And in that moment, our relationship and the things that we know about each other is coming to bear on this to where they can understand God's hatred for sin, His just wrath against it, because they have actually been a recipient of someone else's sin, and they've seen, like, this should not go unpunished. Like, they can get that, you know, but for a lot of people, they're like, oh, yeah, like, I think that makes sense. You know, it's not that helpful. But you, again, you're the evangelist. You decide, I think this is going to be a great question for them. On page 4, it says, many people see, this is the question, the fact they've been made for a purpose is confining rather than loving. Would you agree? Why or why not? And so at this point, we've said God is loving. We've said God is just. And now we're saying He created you with a purpose. And so typically in our culture, most people at least that are probably under 30 at least believe just the idea of freedom is very, very important. They have to have it. And freedom for them means they can do whatever they want. That's what freedom means. I do whatever I want to do. And so we want to help kind of rewire their idea of freedom. And so I asked them, you know, do you think it's confining? You know, that God made you for a specific purpose? And the answer is almost always, yeah. Like, it feels like I ought to be able to do whatever I want to do. And so at that point, I'll share just an illustration with them, just a verbal illustration that I think is helpful. It's not groundbreaking. Probably none of these illustrations are groundbreaking, but they're just simple. And I help it gets people to wrap their mind around it. I say, you know, it's a lot like this, man. Imagine that me and you are at the top of a mountain, and it was really curvy all the way down, and we were on motorcycles, and we were just going to ride down the mountain, you know, here in about 10 minutes. We're kind of packing up our bag, getting ready to go, and we notice right on the way down the hill, there's a sign that says speed limit, 35 miles per hour. And you look at me and you go, man, it stinks. Like, these cops and speed limit signs just trying to confine us and just keep us from having a good time. Dude, just imagine if we could ride our motorcycles down this mountain at 100 miles an hour, just how awesome it would be. It just stinks that these signs are there. And I'm like, dude, why don't we do it? Like, why don't we throw off all constraints? Who cares? Man, well, if we blow past the cops, we'll just go faster. And we bust it down the mountain at 100 miles an hour. And before you know it, we're on the side of the mountain in some kind of tree or dead or whatever. And the point is that we look at freedom and we think freedom is doing whatever we want. But the truth is the freedom is finding the right constraints. And God has told us these things. This is the way you should live. This will flourish you. Do this and it'll go well for you because I love you, because I made you. And so what we want to do is, and you guys could use the illustration about like the fish in the water. You guys, you know, in the water, the fish are cool. If the fish are like, hey, stinks, we have to live in this water all the time. Sure would be awesome if we could just jump out of here, you know, and enjoy life out there on the dry land, you know. But as soon as they do, as soon as they throw off the restraints, they die because they were made for water. That's what they were made for. And so I just think we want to help people understand, like, for most people, and I can't remember his name, but he was hitting on this, in the South, so much of your evangelism, like in the North, I'm getting to tell them what Christianity is. They don't have a bunch of preconceived notions. It's just kind of like they don't have a lot of thoughts. But here, you're always having to rewire. You're always having to say, no, that's actually not what God's like. He's actually like this. And to help people understand that, no, God didn't just come up with just an arbitrary set of rules to just say, I want you to do this and not do that. And that's just the way it is. It's like, no. It's like God's a loving creator, and He gave us the right things that we're to do. And when we throw them off, it's wickedness. It's not just trying to be free. This isn't confining. This keeps us safe. And so, anyways, I think that's helpful for them. But most people, at least that I talk to, have never thought about it like that. And so, on 4, it talks about God's purposes for mankind, knowing Him, making Him known, being like Him. And so the way I try to explain to them what imaging God is like, I like this illustration. I say, man, imagine we were walking through the woods and we're looking down to make sure we didn't trip over anything. And before we knew it, we walked right up into this huge lake. And in the lake is the reflection of this awesome snow-capped mountain. What would you do immediately? And everyone goes, I'd look up. That's right. Why would you look up? He's like, because I want to see the mountain. I want to see the mountain that's being reflected by this lake. And I say, and that's exactly what we were created to do. We were created to image God, to live in such a way that as people interact with us, their knee-jerk reaction would be to glory to God. Like that you remind me of Him. Like your generosity reminds me of His generosity. Your truth-telling reminds me of how truthful He is. The fact that you are faithful to your wife reminds me of His faithfulness. And all those type of things that we were made to live like this is that when people interact with us, that they would think of Him and give glory to Him. And that's what you were created to do, just like that lake is a reflection. But it's not the thing. It's, I want to see the thing. I want to know the actual mountain itself, not just the reflection. Our lives would point people to Him in that way. And so that's just another illustration that I would typically use. And then I would draw the picture at that point. I would say, okay, man, let me kind of sum up what we've said here, draw the picture, and that would bring the information in book one to a close. And then there's parables in the back of each one. And I just, I'm not going to spend a million years talking about the parables because, again, I just believe that you have more than enough people that are very equipped to explain these parables. To you guys at another time, another place, or for you to study them yourself with a good commentary, however you want to do it. But what I am going to tell you is why they're there and the thrust of why we put them in there so that you know, as I say the parable and explain it to this person, why is it here? Why did we put this parable here at this point? And that's what I want to tell you right now. And so this parable, parable of lost sheep and the lost coin, I just think for a lot of people, the parable starts with now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to Him. And the Pharisees and scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. And I just think for a lot of people, they don't think about God like that. They don't think about Christ like that. They're not thinking that He's pursuing sinners, like that He loves and wants to draw back to Himself sinful people, and that when they repent, that He has great joy. Like, no one thinks about God like that, typically. And so that's the thing that we're driving home in this parable, that God is, He's searching out the lost, like He is bringing them back to Himself. And when they repent, there is great joy in heaven. God gets so excited about that. And that's the thing we're pushing in that parable. And you can study it. The questions are simple. It's unnecessary to go through them all. And so that's book one, okay? I'm about to go to book two and talk about it to close our time down. Is there anything about book one that you guys... Okay, book one is done. Okay, nothing else. Okay, book two. Okay, I want to say something about this book. Definitely the hardest book in that this is awesome. This is everything that you're scared to say to a non-Christian in this book. And so it's the one that once you go through it, they're like, I don't want to go through this anymore. I don't want to meet with you anymore. And so I'll go ahead and tell you now, the parable on the back end is kind of a way where we talk to them about, hey, I know this was hard to hear all these things. You've probably never considered these things. But in this journey, in Christ, as we talk about this, there are great riches. Like, you do not want to turn back. And so we'll talk about the parable more in a second, but people are tempted to point back. So I meet with them for book two. I've given it to them the previous week. And so they show up, and we open it up, and I say, hey, man, let's sum up what we said in book one. God is a creator. He's loving. He's just. We've been made in His image. That's what we said. And the book ended and said, how have you done it living that out? Book two, what have I done? Okay, so here we are in book two. What have you done? And they've read it, you know, so we're ready to talk about it. And so we open it up. And so I don't ask the question on book one because I think it's... redundant. There's another question coming up soon that we'll talk about longer. And so I just, you know, and I'll always ask them general questions like, hey, man, did anything stand out in the book to you they want to talk about? You know, I'll let them you know, give their thoughts and times. And so, like, once all that's done, that may never end. Like, they may have so many thoughts, so many questions. I never even dictate what we do. But a lot of times, it's like they may have one or two thoughts, but they're looking to you to lead the time. Like, hey, what are we going to talk about? And so, this is what I would do. On page two, I want you guys to note that when they begin to give that definition of an idol by Tim Keller, that is a confusing paragraph. I don't know that it could be more simple, but I just want you to know that if I've been in a lot of Journey Book conversations about their idolatry, and I begin to realize you don't really understand this, and when I ask you if you understood it, you said yes. And so I just want to alert you to the fact that, just think, I mean, in the church, we talk about idolatry a pretty good amount. It's like a whole paradigm that we understand, but when you're talking to a non-Christian who's never considered any of those things, and you begin to suggest you have these things that you worship that aren't God, that are on a deep level, that's just like, you're breaking completely new ground there. And so you might need to take a second to explain to them how idols function in their lives. And so that question right there, on page two, on the left, using Keller's definition, what are the idols in your life? That's a great time to see if they understand. Just say, well, why did you pick those things, you know? And let them tell you, and just see, do you really understand what it means for you to worship something that's not God? And then I typically will share something about my own life. I'll say, you know, I remember when I was in high school, I worshiped football. Like, I just worshiped at the feet of, you know, everyone thinking I was a good athlete and how much I got the ball. And if I didn't get the ball much, it would just ruin me, you know, and just the effect it had on me and just how it ran my life. And just to say, and football was a terrible god, but I worshiped it. And it not only was it not the God of the universe, but it was ruining me. Not only could it not save me, but it was ruining my life. I really wasn't free. I was a slave to something that could never give me what I really did want. And so I think that just you want to connect with them, because again, just a thought on evangelizing people in at least my and generation and lower is that the idea of freedom is so something they cling to, the thought of being free, and for them to begin to understand that I'm a slave. I'm a slave to sin. I'm a slave to my idolatries. It's like a, whoa, I never thought about it like that. I always thought I was so free. I always thought I was doing whatever I wanted, living the dream. And the better your relationship, the more honest they'll be about the fact that sin is actually wrecking my life, you know, but it's according to how good you know them. So on page three, this is a really big question. How would obeying the golden rule, doing unto others as we would want done to us, be much easier if God's only concern was the outward action and not the heart behind the action? And so obviously in the book, he's made the point that God doesn't just care about what we do. He cares about why we do it, the motives of our heart, why, you know, and in the book right here, it just says, you know, the popular slogan, what would Jesus do? It would probably be much more accurate to say, what would Jesus do, think, feel, desire? Like, everything about him, I'm called to image that, and I can't just go through the motions and do outward things. And I'll share with them this illustration just to kind of drive it home. I'll say, man, what if one day I had told my wife, who had been sick or whatever, hey, Sheffy, this Saturday, I love you. I want to take you on a really cool date to this nearby city, this great restaurant that you love. And she were to say, wow, Zach, I can't wait to go. That sounds awesome. And I say, cool. And so I'm at work that Friday, and I get a call from a buddy, and he's like, hey, Zach, I just got vouchers to this awesome golf course. And I say, man, when? He's like, Saturday. Oh no, this is bad, you know? And I'm like, man, I love to play golf. That course is awesome. Okay, yeah, man, I'm in, okay? And so on the way home, I'm like, okay, how am I gonna explain this to Sheffy? And so I pull over at this place I've never really noticed before. It's this flower shop. And I'm like, hey, you know, there's some flowers. She'll like that. And I'm kind of driving. I'm like, this isn't gonna work. And so then I pull over and I buy her this necklace, you know, and I kind of take it in. And I come in, and I'm like, hey, Chef, how are you doing, you know? And she's like, I'm good. I'm like, hey, I got you something, you know? And these flowers, she's like, oh, I love those flowers, you know? And I'm like, oh, and one other thing, this necklace. She's like, oh, I love that. So pretty. Oh, I love it, you know? She puts it on, and she's like, Zach, why did you do this? I'm like, I love you. I love you. That's why I'm doing it, because I love you, you know? And she's like, wow, that is so sweet. This is amazing, you know? And so she's in there, you know, putting her flowers in the vase. I'm sitting there on the couch, and I'm kind of thinking, I'm like, hey, Chef, so about Saturday, I got a call today, and this guy was talking about this golf course, and I look over, and she's standing there in the doorway with the necklace in her hand, broken off. And I'm like, "What, Chef? Why would you do? Why did you do that?" And I can stop the story. The point is that, and I would ask, "Man, why do you think she's so angry?" And they always tell you, "It's like because you didn't get her those things because you loved her. You did it to manipulate her." And I begin to help them understand, and that's exactly what you're doing to God with your church attendance and these things that you're doing, is that even the things that you're doing, you are trying to make yourself out to be religious, but you're trying to control God. You're trying to say, if I do these things, God, you must do these things. Sheffy, if I bring you these flowers, you will let me go to this. But the reason it doesn't work is because no one functions like that. No one wants that. No one just wants people to go through the motions. We want other people's heart in their actions. My wife wants my heart. And everyone would say that. They would say, yes, if they have a girlfriend, I'll make up some scenario about their girlfriend. They'll say, yes, like, you know, I would. That's what I want from her. And I just think to help people understand that God's not altogether like, just, it's not weird for Him to want our hearts and to want something deep. It's like they can relate with that and say, man, we all want that. We are persons like Him. We want more than just outward actions and duties. And so what happens at this point is super pivotal. Is so they begin to understand the nature of sin on a deeper level than they ever have. And so what we notice is everyone begins to rationalize their sin at this point and say things like they all have these Romans 1, like, suppress the truth responses to these type things. They have, well, I mean, come on, man, everyone makes mistakes, you know, and that's what they say. And so obviously the next paragraph is everyone makes mistakes, and it explains that the sins that you're committing aren't mistakes. They're sins. They're willful rebellion against God. It's not a mistake, okay? And so obviously they've already read that and thought about it, and you're asking them questions like, at the top of page 4, a really key question, would you agree your sin is more than just mistakes? I want to hear them say, man, no, I don't think it is more than mere mistakes. And I'll say, well, man, what about when you do that? Is that a mistake? And for us on the college campus, it always goes like this. So you're telling me when you got drunk and had sex Friday, that was a mistake. You didn't ever think that you were going to do that before Friday. And they're like, well, what'd you do last Friday? Does that make sense? Same thing. Like, the point is that you, these things that you did, you've planned on this. Does that make sense? This isn't like you just found yourself in this situation. You're planning this. This is willful rebellion. This is not a mistake. And so that's a lot of, I mean, I don't know what all things would pop up, but the better you know them, the easier it is. And so I don't typically hit this question on the bottom of page 4, but sometimes I do, especially if a guy, if he's the guy who's just like, man, everything's great, I don't have any problems, everything's awesome, then I'm going to ask him, hey, you know, what are the blessings that you have? And let them name them off and say, how should you respond to those things? Do you realize, again, Romans 1, God's been so gracious to you, and the rightful response is gratitude and thankfulness, and you don't have a drop of that? Like, do you feel the weight and the wickedness of how merciful God has been to you despite your own rebellion? Should that not lead you back to Him? And I just, again, some people feel the weight of that, some don't, okay? And so then on, a lot of these questions are gold, so I'm going to hit a lot of these. Page 5, things going well, they're just saying the common, well, man, things are going great for me. Why would I think God's mad at me? And then the next one is God understands. Man, well, God understands, you know, I'm in college, or I'm, you know, having to do this right now, or whatever, you know, whatever it is that they, I have a lot of college examples, because that's where I'm doing evangelism, but obviously there's all kinds of things that people could rationalize. And then lastly, do you think that most people see that God takes their sin personally? And I just want to hear them process that. Like, do you see this? Like, God is a person who takes this personally. These things that you've done, you are His. Remember, He's your creator. He owns you. You were made for His purposes, not your own. And so when you don't do these things, do you see that this isn't just like some God out there somewhere who's uninterested, but this is God up next to you. He cares about this. When you do these things, He takes it personal. And so let them kind of think through that. And then I draw my, God is, you know, we go back to the illustration I've drawn out in book 1. And I say, look, what have you have done? You've said, no, you're a little G God. I'm big M man. I typically put their, like, Z for Zach in there. I don't put man. Just put their name, make it personal. And we do not have a relationship with God because of the things that you've done. And the book ends with the question, if this is how God feels about your sin, what do you think He's going to do about it? This is one of those moments where I would just say people are not typically like, oh yeah, I'll just can't wait to hear later. It's like, no, they're like, what is He going to do? Like, I've never considered what He's going to do. And they may say, hey, I really don't want to wait a week and say, well, hey, here's a book. Let's meet tomorrow and talk about it. And so draw that. And I think one of the things that, lastly, that I drive home that's not in the book particularly, that's not in the diagram unless you say it, is that because I've situated sin as a distortion of God's image, that He created me for this purpose that I'm not living out, I help them understand why God didn't just pick an arbitrary list of things. Like, it's not like He just made some rules just to confine you, but that my own greed is defiling what God has made me to be, that He is so generous towards us, and yet my greed ruins that because I'm imaging Him. He's made me to live out His image in the world, and so my lies say that He's not a truth teller. I mean, since my adultery, my sexual immorality says that He is not faithful, and you can understand how God could take that so personally because you are His personal being made in His image. And I think it helps people grasp God's law and why He's saying this is the way you ought to live when they understand this isn't about arbitrary laws. This is about persons. This is about relationship that I've ruined. The parable of the rich fool, just driving home, it's like, man, it is foolish for this man to think he's the captain of his own soul. He's got everything he needs. He's just going to ride this thing out. It's like, that's foolish to think this very night your soul will be required of you. And typically what I share with them is the story about that janitor. And I don't share it with them to manipulate them. In my opinion, manipulation is me sharing that story so that I can get them to do something I wouldn't get them to do if I had not shared the story. I have no goal like that. They should be scared. That's true. To pretend that they should not be scared when the weight of their sin has now become personal is a lie. Does that make sense? For me to know a real life experience where a man said, I will live for 50 years, and he lived for 24 hours, that's mercy that I can share that and say, listen, I've known a man who said he would live for 50 years, and he lived 24 hours. I'm not trying to say that to scare you, like, hey, why don't you just pray this prayer with me so you can become a Christian right now? I'm saying that because you're not the captain of your soul, and it is foolishness for you to think, oh, you know what, I don't really like these books, I'm not going to do them anymore. It's like, man, no, you need to keep doing this. You need to know the gospel. This is where everything that you need is located. And so anyways, I like to share that story because it makes it real. And it's just like, man, that's true. Like, there's a real person who is 28. He did not expect to have a massive heart attack, but he doesn't. He's not sovereign over his life. And so that's the main point at the end of that. And then, so that's book two. And we probably went over 43. I don't really know. Okay. Yes, we definitely went over. Does anybody have any questions or thoughts? And then we could probably shut this down. Yeah, you. I'm just kidding.
Just real quick. Uh-huh. So you have this
sort of bottom line principle that you're working all the way through. We're hearing it. But that you're wanting these people to see God made you for this purpose, to reflect His image. And you're just trying to bring them back. How are you doing? How are you doing with that purpose? And the things that are wrecking that in your life and how you've wrecked that in your life. That's sort of a bottom line.
Yep.
Okay.
Definitely.
We'll probably ought to wind down.
Okay. Church in the morning. Great.
We'll go ahead and wind down. And if you have some questions and you're willing to stay, maybe Zach will be willing to stay. They'll be staying at their in-laws just down in Gallatin, and he'll be back in the morning also in our first hour. But we were trying to end at a reasonable time this evening so that you could go home and rest and be ready for the Lord's Day tomorrow. So I'm going to hand the mic over to Chris and ask Chris to close us in prayer.